From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we are talking about the very newest report on poverty in our community, a look at where things stand and in the ongoing effort to battle poverty, where we need to go next. But before we get to that, a bit of breaking news to tell you about. We just got a statement from Governor Andrew Cuomo in regards to the charges filed by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District this morning that include, among other people, Elaine Caballeros, a former member of his administration as well, Joe Prococo. There's a lot going on, and real briefly, we want to bring in our Capitol Bureau correspondent, Karen DeWitt, on the phone. I know it's a busy day for you. Thanks for being here, Karen.
Oh, sure. It's one of those days, though, that I think reporters kind of live for. Everything's happening at once.
Yeah, and I think to some degree there was an idea that this may be coming eventually, but there's a lot that's happened today. What's the short summation for people just catching up on what's going on?
Well, criminal complaints by U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, naming specifically Governor Cuomo's former right-hand man, Joe Prococo, who the governor's late father, Mario Cuomo, referred to as his third son, showing that the two were very close. He's accused Prococo, along with his wife, of essentially pocketing over $300,000 in illegal kickbacks and bribes. Also, the head of SUNY Polytechnic, Elaine Caballeros, and kind of the mastermind of most of Governor Cuomo's upstate economic development programs, including the Buffalo Billion, accused of bid rigging, giving contracts to favored developers who gave a lot of money to Cuomo's campaign. We also found out that a lobbyist closely associated with Cuomo, Todd Howe, yesterday pleaded guilty to several counts, and he's a cooperating witness. So he's apparently giving them a lot of information about what went on behind the scenes in all of these schemes, I guess you can call them.
And from what I can tell with Elaine Caballeros, there are allegations of bid rigging both in Buffalo and I think in Albany for a dorm at SUNY Albany. I mean, there's a lot to sort through and a lot of pages.
Yeah, like
here.
I don't even think I could explain the dorm, the dorm thing, and the whole hour you have for your show. But yeah, essentially, they were gaming this whole system. It was supposed to be bidding on economic development projects, creating jobs for the troubled upstate economy. But instead, according to Preet Bharara, the governor's top contributors got the money to do these projects. And that is, if proven, is illegal.
Karen, as we've discussed, Preet Bharara has been unafraid of being a little, I guess, blunt and sometimes a bit of a showman when it comes to the charges and the effective prosecutions he's had against Sheldon Silver, Dean Skelos. And it wasn't that long ago on Twitter that he came out and said, essentially tamped down speculation that a similar prosecution of the governor himself was coming. But then in a subsequent interview in The New Yorker, he said, "That doesn't mean I said that he's never done anything wrong. It just means that there's not, ammunition for charges against Mr. Cuomo." Well,
yeah,
today,
and Preet was asked about this in this press conference that just concluded. He was asked by a reporter from Newsday, "Well, can you give Governor Cuomo a clean bill of health in this case?" And he essentially said, "Well, let's just say he's not implicated in this criminal complaint, and that's all I'm going to say." I mean, this does look really bad for Governor Cuomo. It would look much worse if he were indicted, of course. But, he has this reputation as being a hands-on manager, a micromanager of everything that goes on in state government. He's very proud of that reputation. So how could he not know all this stuff was going on? At the very least, he showed poor judgment in placing trust in Prococo and Caballeros and essentially giving them free rein to run all of these things.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, let me just briefly read the statement, and we'll get a little bit more from Karen and let her go, because she's got a pile of work to do with this. Here's the statement that came down 5 minutes ago from Governor Andrew Cuomo. Quote, "I learned this morning of the charges filed by the U.S. Attorney's Office that include a former member of my administration. If the allegations are true, I am saddened and profoundly disappointed. I hold my administration to the highest level of integrity. I have zero tolerance for abuse of the public trust from anyone. If anything, a friend should be held to an even higher standard. Like my father before me, I believe public integrity is paramount. This sort of breach, if true, should be and will be punished. SUNY has rightly relieved Elaine Calleiros from his duties and has suspended him without pay, effective immediately. This matter is now in the hands of the court, which is exactly where it belongs. My administration will continue to be fully cooperative in the matter, as we have been since it began. End quote. I don't know if we're going to hear any more from him today. Karen?
I tend to doubt it. I think that statement should stand for itself. And the governor actually has said that for months, ever since the news came out that this investigation was happening. He essentially threw his longtime friend Prococo, as well as lobbyist Todd Howe, under the bus, and has said for months if they did anything wrong, they should be punished to the fullest extent
okay.
of the law.
So last question then for you, Karen, and then we'll look for your reporting throughout the day, both on WXXINews.org and All Things Considered and everywhere else you'll find it on our platforms. Karen, whether it is Maggie Brooks, Andrew Cuomo, other executives who have never been implicated directly themselves, but they've had people around them in sort of these pay-to-play and scandals of various forms, I guess, as you framed it perfectly. Either they did know, and they're micromanagers, and they simply, there's not a trail directly to them, or they were ignorant of what was going on around them. Either way, it's not good. What I want to know is this. Cuomo has said since he first campaigned for governor, he wants to have the cleanest administration, restore the public trust. You see it in this statement. Is there any way for him to move forward and sort of remove the tinge of scandal around him?
Wow, I really don't know the answer to that question. It depends if this whole thing goes to trial. Preet Bharara kind of said, we hope this goes to trial so everyone can see the details, which makes me think maybe some people might just do a plead to some of the charges and you know, end all the negative news stories. But look at into New Jersey, Governor Chris Christie and Bridgegate. That kind of ruined him for the presidency, which he was trying to seek, and possibly to ever run as governor again. So it, you know, it may mean that the governor's so tainted that he can't seek a third term as governor.
Karen DeWitt, great reporting as always, and we look forward to much more from you today. Thank you for the time.
You're very welcome.
Karen DeWitt reporting for us. And if you want to see, if you want to share the story, the statement from the governor and the work we've been doing, WXXINews.org will continue to update that as we follow the story of these charges of corruption, bid rigging, and more with many of the people directly surrounding Andrew Cuomo, but not the governor himself. Okay, setting that aside, let's talk about what we aim to talk about this hour, which is the situation on poverty in our community. It was, I think it was earlier this year, when Ed Doherty, the man who wrote that original poverty report, said on this program to a caller who said, tell me one thing that can be done in a year. And Ed said, don't ask what can be done in a year. This is not a one-year problem. This is not a two-year problem. This is a 15 to 30-year problem. What we do know is this, though. This newest report indicates that in 2010, Rochester had 27 neighborhoods classified as extremely poor. Today, 37 neighborhoods. That in the latest report, there was somewhere in the range of 31% poverty for all Rochester citizens. Now it's over 33%. So we've seen a slight uptick. It's going to take some time for things to take effect, but let's talk this hour about what we know and where we go next. Ed Doherty's here. Not only the author of that original report, but an associate with SCI. I'm not the first who's done that, Ed, who were hired to write this report now, and he's done a lot of work on it. Nice to see you back here. Thanks for being here, Ed.
Happy to be here.
Ann Johnson's here, ACT Rochester Senior Director. And Ann, thanks for being here to you.
Very pleased to be here.
Henry Fitz is here with the City of Rochester Innovation Team. Henry, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Not a one-year problem, right, Ed? We're seeing that in this report, aren't we?
Well, absolutely. First of all, the data that is in this report is the most up-to-date data available. But even so, there's lags in the data, and much of the information in this report reflects a time before the poverty initiative was even begun.
Okay.
So this cannot be seen in any way as an evaluation or a reflection on the progress the community has made. What it does show is the magnitude of the problem is every bit as deep as we thought, that it has gotten deeper and more challenging and continues to do so.
And we're going to work through what we know in this report very specifically when it comes to, for example, women in poverty, single women as heads of households, how Rochester compares, how our city compares around the country. So we'll work through that. And listeners, I would just say what you just heard from Ed is not a cop-out. This is not a sort of either a pass the buck or a cop out on give us more time. He's right. A lot of this data is before a lot of the efforts even started. And I'm an evidence guy. It is going to take some time, Ann Johnson. I mean, this community, I think, is going to have to embrace the idea that we don't know 15 years from now if we'll sit at this table and be able to say, you know, we've at least started a long climb out and we've made tremendous progress. If 25 years from now, there's a little faith the community needs to have that the people are doing the right things. But what is this? What do these numbers say to you?
Well, these numbers say that we have a concentration of poverty challenge as well as an overall city challenge for poverty. And it identifies some of the different populations that have a greater challenge, as you mentioned, single, female head of household with children. 60% of those in the city are in poverty. So as we look at solutions, maybe 15 years from now, we've figured out in certain populations how to cut that poverty in half. But we've got to look for things that work for different types of families with different types of challenges. And if we do that and we have the collaboration that is mentioned in the report that has really come together boldly in these last 2 years, then we should see some progress. But as you said, no one has that magic prediction ability of exactly what it will be.
Let me ask Henry what the role of the City of Rochester's innovation team is here. Is it looking at the data, collecting it, analyzing it, helping formulate ideas here? What's your role in this process?
Sure, absolutely. We work very closely with the Rochester Monroe NA Poverty Initiative. Ed and I both sit on the data team, which Ed chairs, which helps look through the available data we have and also try to get access to additional data that can help us better understand the problems and better tailor the solutions that we bring. So my team specifically lends our capacity to the Anti-Poverty Initiative as a data analysis, program design, and evaluation team to help design, launch, and measure the effectiveness of what we're doing. And we're excited and about to gear up to really launch some great strategies here.
Okay. You want to break any news? Are you allowed to talk about what you, I mean, when you talk about launching strategies here, that is a process that's been unfolding over a number of months here, and I want to start trying to understand what we're doing about this. So how much are you allowed to tell us here, Henry?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think it's been reported on a little bit. One of the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative's pilot strategies that's going to be piloted is called the Adult Mentor Navigator Program, Mentors for Success. We're gearing up in partnership with Catholic Family Center, ABC, and Community Place of Greater Rochester to launch that program in the three neighborhoods that we're targeting. And again, like all the things that we're doing, starting small, measuring rigorously, showing evidence and impact, and then using that to scale up our efforts through funding and bring it to the rest of the city.
Sure. Listeners, if you've got questions about, you want to just know some of the details on what poverty is, you know, what the numbers are when it comes to poverty or some of the context, some thoughts on what happens next, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. I have a number of comments that came in before the show to our website. We'll get to those as well. Ed, for you here, you know, we have talked about concentration of poverty. So what does some of the data show us when it comes to just how concentrated we are?
Well, that's the primary issue that is facing this community. I do not see that we have a poverty problem per se. If we look at the nine-county region, our poverty rate is lower than the national average. It is only when we look at the dramatic concentration of poverty in the city that we get numbers where we are still the fifth poorest city in the country and the second poorest city of our size, and have the highest poverty rate among children of any city our size. Those facts are driven entirely by the extreme concentration of poverty that we have in this community. It's more extraordinary than exists in most communities, and it has a big effect. It's not only shows up in the numbers, but it affects what goes on in our schools. It affects what goes on in our communities, and it's really the biggest challenge I think that we have is to not just look at poverty and how we find some solutions to poverty, but how we find some solutions to this issue of our dramatic concentration.
All right, so 37 neighborhoods of extreme poverty versus 27 in 2010. Do we have a good handle at all on why?
Well, you know, we didn't repeat it in this study, but the first study spent a fair amount of time looking at the way in which Rochester's developed, well, how Rochester developed as a community and looked at issues of racial segregation, which even today, as we use current numbers, we are a considerably more segregated community than most other cities. And so that's the fact that first comes to my mind, our legacy as well as our continued patterns of segregation. The approach to sprawl or the non-approach to sprawl that we have taken, we've had sort of virtually unmanaged sprawl in this metropolitan area, and that's resulted in a significant a change in the way in which income has been distributed geographically around the region. Again, that happens in most cities, but it has been extraordinary in the degree here. We also have a very restrictive reality when it comes to housing. People of low income, especially families of low income, and that shows up in this new report in a very dramatic way. Families of low income have very, very few choices in terms of where they are able to live, in terms of the availability of rental property at all, and especially the availability of rental property that has the kind of subsidies that are necessary for people of very low income. And so you have those kinds of practices, you have those kinds of realities, you're going to get a dramatic concentration. We've never developed any policies that I'm aware of to address this, and I think that that's coming home to show itself.
And when it comes to people, families in poverty, not having a lot of choices on where to live, that is true around the country, but again, even more so here, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things we looked at in the original study was that more than 50% of Monroe County's total rental housing is in the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have, our suburban communities have not developed in ways that are welcoming to any rental populations, let alone rental populations of people who are poor, and especially rental properties for poor people with families.
I had a conversation yesterday that I can't fully get into the details on because it's on a long-term reporting project that's coming soon on WXXI. But it's with someone who's been a community leader who said to me, we cannot workshop our way out of racial segregation, and with cultural dissonance and problems, we cannot have summits and conferences. We have to live and work among one another of difference, and we do not right now. Ed, true?
That more so than other communities, we continue to be racially segregated in our residential patterns. Absolutely, and it shows up very clearly. You know, people of different races have dramatically different perspectives on what these matters mean. It shows up in the data very clearly, and it shows up when you talk to people. You know, I've made presentations that have been attended by more than 3,000 people in this community over the last several years. And most of them, not all, but most of them are people, are not people of color. Mm-hmm. They are people Caucasian background, and both in the city and in the suburbs. And they seem shocked. They seem shocked that these numbers are the way they are. And I think it's just that point that you were making. You know, it starts off by knowing each other, understanding each other, and we have a long way to go in this community.
We've got a bubble. Ann Johnson, I want to hear from you on this, and then I'll grab our first phone call. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that issue of racial segregation, mm-hmm. I don't know how, and, you know, I think Leonard Brock mm-hmm. has the hardest job in this city, this mm-hmm. region, because he's got to work with so many different people. He's got to work with elected leaders. These are not easy issues to talk about or handle. You know, are you confident that what you're seeing, that this data is helping people make the right steps so far?
Well, the reason we put these reports out is to help people learn and understand and to connect with each other and then take action. That's what ACT Rochester is all about. And we think it's important to continue to shed light on what's happening. This particular report had a little bit of reference to race, but you, as you know, every year ACT Rochester updates its race data and puts out a report that is the life cycle of someone who is of color compared to those who are white. And the numbers are, they're pretty jaw-dropping. When what we do is we show what the U.S. numbers are and also what the region is. And we as a region, and especially in the city in Monroe County, have much more challenging numbers than people of color of the same ethnicity and race in the United States. And so the disparities and inequities are not improving, and we want to keep the visibility on that. One of the principles from the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative is to ask everyone to keep structural racism, you know, in mind. And, you know, a lot of people are unaware and think everything's fine. And we just want to keep being sure that the work that's happening is highlighted and measured.
All right, let me get our first phone call. And if you want to join the program with your thoughts on poverty and what you're hearing about our segregated community, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255. In Rochester, this is Iskra. Go ahead, Iskra.
Hi, I'm chair of an organization from the Monroe County Bar called Lawyers for Learning. And what we do is we pair attorneys, local attorneys, with elementary age students at inner city schools, and right now we focus on school 29. And the goal of the program is hopefully to combat poverty and you know, raise these students up to pursue school in the future, potentially become lawyers or other achievements. But people have in the past suggested that we consider you know, focusing more on the parents instead of the students, because a lot of times when the kids are leaving elementary school and they get into middle school or high school, we lose, you know, touch of them. Sometimes they, you know, the dropout rate hasn't changed much in terms of our efforts. And I'm wondering if you think that these mentorship programs are useful, or, you know, I think that they are, but I'm just wondering what your commentary is on that. I know you mentioned briefly mentoring programs in the beginning of the program. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that and combating poverty.
Thank you, Iskra. We'll go around the table. Ann?
So for those initiatives in our community that work with children, you know, the Children's Agenda, Rock the Future, which looks at Rochester City School District, we've seen over the last couple years a major focus on multi-generational, so the parents and the children being involved. So there's a Parent Leadership Institute that is currently in place that's having great success. They work with 50 to 60 parents a year, and then those parents get involved in the community after they finish the training and the work. Rock the Future, which is our initiative to look at cradle to career, has just added a focus subgroup that is parent focused. So all efforts help. I think the trend now is to be sure that youth and parents are engaged, if possible, in the initiative as they're being designed.
Okay. Henry, what do you think?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'll just admit one distinction. The adult mentor program that RMAPI is launching is a paid mentor model. It's really an intensive case management model that works with both a head of household as well as any dependents that they have to systematically assess where they are in their life and any barriers to employment or educational success, and address those barriers through targeted service provision in a coordinated network of providers. So certainly that we think that this is a model that's had success in Boston through the Crittenden Women's Union, and they just renamed themselves Empath. But certainly a really interesting model that we want to replicate here and see if it works.
Okay. Ed Doherty?
Well, yes. You know, obviously any efforts to work directly with students and their families are helpful. And we have thousands of people in this community doing that. The number of tutoring and mentor programs is significant. We think that they do show great results. In a few cases, especially when they were around some summer learning things, they produce some very quick results. So there's little doubt in my mind that those types of programs will help. The problem that I see, and I do have some thoughts on how they might be managed a little bit differently, but that's for another time. The problem that I see is that the order of magnitude of poverty problems within our schools is unbelievably dramatic. Now, Poverty in schools is measured slightly differently than the way these numbers are presented. They use the free and reduced lunch criteria. But in the city's elementary schools now, we have a situation where a majority of city students are in schools of 90% or more poverty, three-quarters in schools of 80% or more poverty. Those are concentration numbers that exist in very, very few places in the entire country. And poverty is the single most observable correlation to poor educational outcomes. And there are good reasons that that happens. People tend to dismiss it, but there really are good reasons why that happens. So if we're not going to address the poverty situation, we're going to be putting Band-Aids on. And that's a tough thing to say to people who are working real hard and trying to help. I encourage them to keep doing, because sometimes you can break through, and the Band-Aids, even if they're only that, are very, very helpful. But the third grade reading numbers in our community now are at a point that it is clear the system is totally failing. And so we really need to look at this. I've done some data analysis that's looked at educational outcomes and non-proficiency on third grade reading scores in the suburbs in Monroe County. And even where there are nuanced changes in poverty level among the suburban districts, they have corresponding changes in non-proficiency. In other words, even when you get outside the city where the poverty concentration numbers are much lower, you still see that relationship between poverty and academic outcomes. How we can ignore the number one factor and try to address everything else around it is somewhat bewildering to me.
So let me ask you a blunt question then, Ed. Does it drive you a little nuts when you see all these people with all these great reform ideas for urban schools when in your mind you're going, great, but with intractable poverty, you may get a little dent, but you're not going to fix it?
Yeah, I think it does a bit. Yeah.
He's going to leave it there. I have a question that came in before the hour, and I actually don't have a name on this, but this came in through our website. So apologize for not having a name here, but it says this. So all the influx of residents in the new upscale and middle-class housing and gentrified city neighborhoods has not outweighed the current number of officially poverty-defined residents. What's plan B? Build even more upscale housing? I think there's some sarcasm there, but just let me ask you. That comes from Benny. Okay, Benny. Okay. Benny's question there.
I'd love to take that one on. First of all, we need to look at everything. Okay, we need to look at moving people out of poverty. We need to look at providing opportunities for poor people to live wherever they may wish throughout the community. And we certainly need to look at creating more community within the city of Rochester that is not poor. Now, the upscale neighborhood ideas, the empty nesters and those, that's a piece of the equation. But what we really seldom hear talked about in Rochester is this idea of building, and I'm going to use a term that I almost have never heard in this community, integrated middle-class neighborhoods. We have a sense that a middle-class neighborhood should be black or should be white. And that's, in fact, the way they have developed substantially in our greater Rochester area. But we're really going to make a dent when we can create middle-class neighborhoods of people who have school children and are integrated. And when I use the term middle-class, that's not a code word for white. That I am referring to integrated middle-class neighborhoods. And that's the kind of strategy that I think is much trickier to do, but is going to have some better results than, just simply focusing on the more wealthy segments that are interested in an urban experience.
Okay. Let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back here, we'll get back to your phone calls. Robert in Fairport will come to you. Will, got your email. Gwendolyn in Lyons will get you. Jack, I've got an email from you. We'll get to a lot of listener questions and comments about the state of poverty in our area. If you want to read the report from ACT Rochester and the Community Foundation, the September 2016 special update on poverty and self-sufficiency in the 9-county greater Rochester area. We'll make sure it is linked in various places. I'll link to it on our Twitter accounts. We'll also have it linked on the podcast of this program once it's on the website later, so you can read through it yourself. And I think Ed's comment was, all you need to know about concentration of poverty is the fact that in the 9-county area, we don't really have an extraordinary poverty problem at the whole numbers, 9 counties. When you look at Rochester, among the greatest poverty, a concentration of poverty in our entire country. So let's get a break and come back to your questions next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, we've been talking cost of college lately. Have we reached the breaking point? A recent U of R grad has written a book about it. He says, yes. Then in our second hour, we're talking about Reading Local. It's a program by Writers and Books that encourages readers to enjoy books published right here in Rochester. And first up is a novel by a Danish author who will join us. We'll tell you about all of that and more Friday. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We've got about 20-plus minutes to cover a lot of ground here, so let's move quickly. And let me go ahead and start with Gwendolyn and Lyons. Go ahead, Gwendolyn.
Hi. I have a comment, really, more than a question.
Okay.
As brain research is showing that the brain is developing more birth to three, and yet very little of our, and I'm a public school teacher who just retired, very little of our trying to change things in our community is focusing on getting parents to read to their children. And, yeah, we've got universal pre-K, we've got the Head Start program, but those kids are already 3 years old, two and three by the time they enter. I'd like to see more focus on getting the pediatricians and other, if they go to a social services meeting, every time a child under the age of three walks out, they have two or three books in their hand. Just as a way our community can help encourage that important brain growth time so that when they get to third grade, they have maybe a chance.
Yeah, thank you, Gwendolyn. I mean, I think that lines up with, I don't think our guests would have any disagreement on the value of of what you're talking about there. And there's plenty of evidence that it can help.
And there are programs that are attempting to achieve that. You know, certainly through the Nurse Family Partnership, pediatricians are getting information through the nursing community about what's going on in these targeted homes. Unfortunately, we are talking about homes that are so remarkably stressed, typically, frequently single-parent homes, frequently very low-educated homes. The city school district estimates that I think about half of the incoming kindergarten classes are fluctuates from year to year, but about half their parents did not graduate from high school. And so, you know, you're already talking about a population that's not going to take these kinds of suggestions in the way that those of us who have been fortunate to have a good education perceive them. It's going to have to be done in different kinds of ways. But it's still a very powerful concept, and I think people are working hard to try to make that happen.
Yeah, boy, oh boy. And you mentioned single-parent households, usually women, and what this report finds, not surprisingly, but the support this report finds, that is an extreme poverty situation, usually female, single parents. They're in a lot of trouble, right? And Ed?
Absolutely. 81% of the poor children in the city of Rochester are the children of single female-headed households.
81% of the poor kids.
That's correct. Wow. So it's a dramatic factor. Now, it's important to realize that that's not as simple a population as you might think. It includes single people. It includes divorced people. It includes grandparents bringing up children, includes a large number of circumstances, but it's certainly probably something that we just need to spend a lot more time focusing on.
Okay, on the subject of family structure and impact on poverty, Robert in Fairport wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Robert.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I read the report, and one thing that just really jumps out of the page is that chart number 6 in the report, the poverty and family structure. Mm-hmm. Families in the city of Rochester of married couples, the poverty rate is 11.6%. Female-headed families with no husband present with children under 18, 59.9% poverty level. It's about a five-fold difference between the two groups. And I just think if family structure is not focused on here, this problem is not going to go away. And I'm kind of curious why the whole family structure thing is not a public health issue like smoking is, because it just seems like it's as dangerous to the health of the financial health of the community. The other thing, too, is that, you know, societally there's an emphasis on education in certain cultures and not in other cultures. And the recent influx of refugees into the Rochester area, looking at the school attendance by the refugees and how much higher it is than natives, is another thing that really suggests it's a cultural issue.
Thank you, Robert.
Well, we just talked about that number. Robert was probably trying to get through on the phone when we were talking about it, so we certainly concur that that's a very critical number. Now, I do want to make an important point here. it's not like there's something in the water in the city that is causing the city to have more people in this category be poor. I happen to know that because I was in charge of the city's water supply for 20 years. So, but what it really is the fact that 36% of the region's population of single female-headed households are located within the city. That is where housing is available to this group. And that concentration issue is what drives the concentration of poverty. The differentials are the same in the suburbs as well between the general population and this particular group. But the concentration, again, is so high in the city that continues to be the driving factor.
Okay. Anything to add?
And when you're a single parent, you're the one balancing all of the different challenges that are stressful in your life and trying to bring in an income, working sometimes multiple jobs. So while family structure is a key challenge in the number of people who are poor, we certainly can't legislate or do anything official to drive what people have a choice of on what family they are.
Okay. Anything to add, Henry?
Yeah, I just, you know, financial stress is one of the number one reasons marriages and relationships break apart. So people in poverty can be disproportionately affected by that stress.
Mm-hmm. And for those who are concerned that family structure doesn't get attention or gets kind of set aside, I want to read a headline for you from the Democrat and Chronicle. Fuming mayor says violence must stop. The mayor, and I'm going to read from the Democrat and Chronicle article. The mayor is calling on African-American men to rise up for the sake of their community after the latest shooting death of a black teenager in the city. Quote, "Today I am pissed off beyond words. I am angry," the mayor said at a news conference at City Hall. "The death of Letitia Parson should be a rallying cry for African-American men in Rochester. I'm calling on these men to get off their behinds and to get involved in saving this community." And the mayor announced he was calling a summit of 100 black leaders this coming Friday to City Hall. I didn't mention the mayor's name. That's not Lovely Warren. That's September 14th, 2002, Bill Johnson. And I remember that news conference. I'd just gotten to Rochester. I remember the death of Letitia Parson. And I remember the frustration. Now, the problem is, I think if you're a white person sitting in the suburbs, there's a temptation to say, see, that black mayor is calling out black men. Damn right. Fix it. And it's much more complex than that. I thought that was a moment where the mayor was admitting, yes, there's lots of components to this, to Robert's point. Family structure is one of them. When you've got a single parent in Rochester, it's usually a woman, and they are in trouble. And those kids are in trouble. And that is hard to break out of that. So that's part of it. But Ed Doherty, we're not going to get most of those black men that Bill Johnson was talking about 14 years ago this week a lot of help until there is a sort of a widespread plan to alleviate poverty in general, right?
Well, I mean, the quote—
That's not passing the buck.
No, I understand that. And that quote that you used is one of a number of instances when Mayor Johnson attempted—
Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember it extremely well, yes. I was at City Hall at the time. And Mayor Johnson was very active in calling upon everybody in the community to find the ways that they could contribute to improving things. Now, the structural issues in black families is something that's been written about a little bit over the last 100 years, and it's a fairly complex and deep issue, and it is not something that has just suddenly come upon us. It is something that has been recognized for a good number of generations. And, of course, you know, it does go, a lot of people hate it when you say this, but it does go back to slavery. There's no question whatsoever about it that the family as a unit has had a deep problem being identified as being as important as it needs to be. So this is a complex issue, not one that we're going to solve, but one that we have to understand its complexity and understand how we can go about working with the community to try to improve the way in which families are structured. No question that family structure and poverty are extremely correlated. Is it cause and effect? Henry makes some interesting points. You know, obviously people who happen to be in dysfunctional family environments are also going to have a hard time staying out of poverty. So we have to look at, you know, all these causes and effects. It's a very complex issue.
Well, I want you to pick up a thread here that in our brief break we talked about, because we opened the hour by mentioning, and I think, again, stressing the point that a lot of the data we're working with here that comes out in this brand new report does come right at the time, or even before the time, when the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative was really rolling out here, and it's going to take a long time. So for those who say, see, it's not working, you really don't have that evidence yet, and it's going to take some time. But Ed, you did mention in our brief break that even early on, you see some glimmers of hope, things that are starting to look like they're bearing some fruit.
Absolutely. And we spend a good amount of time in this report on that. And I hope people will look at that elements. The kinds of initiatives that are taking place in the community have a coordination that hasn't been always the hallmark of the way we've approached problems here. So we're looking at a variety of different segments coming together to try to coordinate. I like to think of it as, you know, we're trying to scale this mountain, and now we're getting the team together, we're getting the equipment together, we're going to wind up going up some bad paths and having to go up and come back down and try a few times. But unlike in past years, we're not just sitting there looking at the mountain. So we're trying to do that. Now, one thing that Henry might be able to talk about is the way in which we're trying to coordinate these efforts geographically so that we can change the way in which we evaluate how effective we are. Henry, you want to mention?
Yeah.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think given some of our, we did a little historical research on past poverty efforts and in Rochester and other places, and tried to see how we could, you know, make things, improve things this time around. And, you know, one thing that was a challenge is past efforts went too big, too fast. They went the whole city. They tried to do everything for everybody and ended up fizzling and things of that nature. This time, and also given the concentration issue that we've identified, we wanted to focus our community's efforts geographically in three target neighborhoods where we can really have the whole community and all the various partners focus their energy and resources over, you know, the next couple years to really and measure it rigorously and see if we can start to move the needle. So our team helped do a data-driven analysis to help select that area. I think I spoke about it last time I was on. And it's an area that has challenges, but it's an area that also has good existing resources to, if they're better connected, maybe a little better funded, we can start to move the needle in this area. So yeah, in addition to what we're doing in partnership with the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative, the city is going to be launching a few of its own signature projects in the same geography and some key initiatives of the Mayor Warren.
All right. So when it comes to then figuring out how to take that and scaling it up here, because ultimately that's the goal, right? You, instead of going too big too soon and one size fits all that has sort of failed in the past, you have these target areas, target neighborhoods, trying to identify specific problems of need, trying to address those, seeing what works. And then, you know, every neighborhood's a little different, but do you think that is the goal to scale that up eventually, Henry?
Absolutely. And I think we're laying the groundwork to make that happen by building in the capacity to track data at a person level that we can show, you know, these programs or these initiatives are having an impact on a person's earnings or their educational outcomes or other really important factors, and that we have that level of evidence that will not only show success but help us attract funding that will help us scale up to the rest of the city. Certainly, you know, this area has some unique features, but in general, it's a microcosm of the whole city.
Ann Johnson?
And I really think this is an important point for your listeners. In the past, organizations that support poor people have been very siloed, and they can be successful in the mission that they are responsible for, and yet the person remains in poverty or poor, maybe not in true poverty. And this whole approach does not only the collaboration we've talked about, but it's going to look at how at the person, person-centered, being tracked, and then understanding the types of services that are working in that particular situation the best. And that's hard because of privacy issues and many other things, but that's the goal of this community, and it's one of the things that's making this effort very unique. We're taking on the big one.
All right, before I get back to the phones, let me just ask that, on that person-centered approach, and you mentioned people can be very private, et cetera. So far, from what you have seen the different people involved with the Anti-Poverty Initiative doing, are we seeing individuals in poverty open to sort of outreach and open to, you know, discussing, we don't have a car, we don't have transport, we have transportation issues, these are our finances, this is what we do. I mean, Henry, are we getting that cooperation?
Absolutely. And one thing my team helped coordinate in support of all this work was a door-to-door survey that we completed this May timeframe. It was actually a statistically significant sample size for the area. Over 400 households responded, and many of them in poverty, asking them about, you know, their unique challenges as well as their perceptions on services in the community and what could help them and their neighbors in their neighborhood. And very warm reception and really great data. If you want to check out that report, it's also on our website as well as the Anti-Poverty Initiative website.
Okay.
Evan, there's also at a organization level, a couple of teams working on data sharing. So while the person who's in poverty might be willing for their information to be shared, we have organizations who collect information and have not been able to share it so that the person or the youth is best able to be helped. And we're aggressively approaching and understanding what types of documents and agreements we need to do that.
Okay. Let me get back to your phone calls. Jane in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes. Evan, we have talked about how poverty is reached suburbia and that people who were middle class have sunken into, at times, poverty and are now destitute. We don't blame people if they're white. We don't say it's their family structure. There are a lot of reasons for people being destitute, and I just lament the fact that black or white, middle class formerly or in poverty, 86% of men who've divorced do not pay anything in child support. Even if they're able to, they do not pay. And I feel like there's an avoidance of looking at men and their irresponsibility. You want to look carefully, it seems, at black men and their failures, but you don't include white men, and we never seem to do anything serious nationally, about the irresponsibility with child support. They do nothing. So I see it more, it's not a class, it's not even a race, it's a gender issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. I think that comment probably stands on its own. I mean, I certainly take the point. You know, I could read another email. In fact, I got an email, Jane, from a listener named Jack who goes even farther. He says, let's stop talking about race entirely. Only talk about socioeconomics. Now, Ed?
I'm going to jump because I hear that comment probably every time we have a conversation.
And every time you do a community presentation?
Very frequently, yes. And that comment has been made by people who are involved in this initiative, and it's a valid concept if we want to believe that we are a race blind society, but the data, you can't ignore this data. You are three times as more likely to be in poverty if you're an African American in our entire region. That's not in the city. That's in our entire region. Same thing is true if you're a Latino. Now, if you have a population that is three times more likely to be poor, and you're going to deal with the subject of poverty, you can't say, well, I'm not going to talk about race. Now, it would be good to have a very mature conversation about the issues of race to understand why, years after laws have been passed to try to avoid the kinds of economic disparity that exists, why that still exists. My own experience is that there's plenty of out-and-out racial discrimination. I mean, I've seen it in my entire career. Some of it is overt. Much of it is not overt.
Right.
I mean, a number of times that I've heard someone say, well, I don't want to hire a person of that background because they'll be so hard to manage, or they'll be so hard to, you know, and it's just pure racism. So it exists, and the magnitude to which it exists is hard to know. But we cannot address this problem without acknowledging those realities.
Yeah, and to Jack, I would just say a lot of people are talking about some police shootings this week, and the video from Tulsa is shocking. Mm-hmm. In that video in Tulsa, before that shooting happens, you hear one of the officers say about a black man, a tall black man walking with his hands up slowly, "That looks like a pretty bad dude." What in the world made that look like a bad dude, other than that he was a black man? And to Ed's point there, that might, you might not even realize when you're making that kind of a comment what's going on. But so Jack, I appreciate the email, and I think in an ideal world you could stop talking about race and only talk about socioeconomics, but that's tough. One more quick listener question. Sarah says, just wanted to know if the report focuses at all on access to contraception. And I don't think so. But, you know, I think I'm inferring from her viewpoint that at least comprehensive sexual education and access to contraception certainly helps in poverty. And so, Sarah, thanks for the comment. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we'll probably discuss here on a separate program coming up here. I want to end on a little bit of a note of hope. Ann Johnson, you know, it's going to take a while here, and this report is really harrowing. Give it 30 seconds. Give me something that gives you hope as we go forward on this.
What gives me hope is that people are more aware of what's happening in our community. They're starting to understand it more, and the groups that are working together and taking this on at the bottom of that mountain are collaborating and truly working together for the betterment of the community.
Yeah. Henry, you feel the same way?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, organizations are at a point now where they're thinking about fundamentally changing the way that they do their business to help impact this issue, not just fund new programs.
Well, the really interesting thing about Henry and the innovation team doing this targeted neighborhoods and person-centered stuff is that is where we may not get a community-wide impact on poverty for a while, but we'll start to see results, and, you know, we'll be able to talk in 6 months, a year, 18 months, and see what's going on. And so I hope you'll keep coming back. Thank you for being here, Henry.
Absolutely.
Ann Johnson from ACT Rochester. Great work on this report, and thank you for being here as
thank
well.
Thank you.
And Ed Doherty, I'm going to keep inviting you back because we need frank discussion on this, and I want to thank you
thank
for the
you.
Work you do.
Great to be here. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for all the calls and feedback both hours today. Rob Braden's the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk with you Friday on Member Supported Public Radio.